Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. Once again, we are live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon, Pacific, I guess it's still Pacific Daylight Time, isn't it? Hasn't changed time, it hasn't changed from daylight savings time yet. As far as I know, I'm not in California right now, I'm in Sweden, so I'm not keeping track of those things very well, but I think pretty soon I'm going to have to start saying Pacific Standard Time, but I don't think that time is yet. So if you're listening to the live broadcast, we are capable of taking calls from you. If you have a question about the Bible or about Christianity, or if you have a difference of opinion from the host and you have a desire to express that, to defend an alternate viewpoint, to balance comment, you can do that in this coming hour. And you just need to know this phone number. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Now, I just want to tell my producer, it may not be something we can do anything about, but I'm hearing an echo in my headset. I'm not sure if that's coming over the air that way. I'm not sure if anything can be done about it. I am, after all, quite a distance from home, and connected over the Internet is how I communicate with you right now. Anyway, our phone number is 1-800-438-5090, and our first caller today is Frank, who's calling from Santa Cruz, California, my hometown. Hi, Frank. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hey, Steve. Good evening in your end of the world.
Yeah, good to hear from you, brother.
Yeah, first time calling in.
Well, I'm glad to hear from you.
I have a question about Matthew 10. As you know, I'm compiling a one-year highly parallel chronological Bible, which you have a link to on your homepage. Thanks for that.
That's right.
And I'm down into the Gospels now and ran across Matthew 10, verses 17 through 22, which are highly parallel to Mark 13, 9 through 13, and Luke 21, 12 through 17.
That's
correct. Which are, of course, in the Olivet Discourse.
Yeah.
And interestingly, Matthew in 24, when he gets to that point, is silent. He doesn't repeat those words. So Matthew reports them only at the point that he's that Jesus is sending the 12 out for their first preaching tour, and Mark and Luke report those words only as part of the Olivet Discourse. So Matthew doesn't say them in the Olivet Discourse.
That's right.
So. I'm wondering, when did Jesus actually utter those words? Perhaps he uttered them twice, and Matthew reported the first time, and Mark and Luke the second time, but it seems a bit surprising that Matthew would leave it out of the Olivet Discourse if it was there, even if it was repeated.
Yeah.
So what's your take on that?
In my opinion, Mark and Luke are correct in including those words in the Olivet Discourse. And I believe that, Matthew, as we have to observe, has arranged the teachings of Jesus more in a topical arrangement than in a chronological arrangement. And that's why we have in Matthew 5 blocks, rather large blocks of Jesus' teaching. And each block, there's 5 of them, each block of teaching has specimens of Jesus' teaching, which actually are taken from various points of time in his ministry and gathered, apparently because of their topical relevance to each other, into collections. And I think everyone who studies Matthew knows that Matthew has done this. It's not always clear why he included something in one of his collections, and this may be a question here. In my opinion, there's 2 occasions, of course, when Jesus talked to his disciples about what would happen to them as they went out and preached the gospel. One was when he sent them out 2 by 2, the 12, and the other is, of course, he was going to send them out eventually to the world after his ascension. And it would appear that when he gave the Olivet Discourse, as per Luke 21 and Mark 13, that he gave, on that occasion, warnings about how they would be brought before the synagogues and all of that, and how they would suffer for his name's sake and bear testimony in all nations. But Matthew, for some reason, when he decided to give the missionary discourse, as I would call it, in Matthew 10, which was on the occasion of Jesus sending out the 12, he conflated that with things that Jesus had said elsewhere, including that material from the Olivet Discourse. And we know that Matthew 10 has a parallel, you know, in Luke 9, where Jesus sent out the 12. And if we compare the parallel, only a very, very small portion of what's in Luke 10 probably belonged to the occasion of him sending out the 12, two by two. And the rest of it comes from places like the Olivet Discourse, like this does, and from other places in Jesus' teaching, where apparently Matthew felt this was a good time just on telling the story of Jesus sending out the 12 and giving basic instructions for this short-term mission. This is a good time, in Matthew's judgment, apparently, to include a lot of the things Jesus said about the later missions of the disciples, not just this short-term one. It's clear in chapter 10 that not everything that is in chapter 10 could possibly apply to this short-term mission, including the passage you're talking about, because he was sending them out only to the villages of Galilee. He was not sending them out to the Gentiles. And yet in this passage, he talks about them giving testimony before the Gentiles for his sake in verse 18. And that would be relevant chronologically to the things he was saying in the Olivet Discourse, where he was saying this gospel will be preached in all the world as a witness to all nations and so forth. Here, his statement to them in Matthew 10 about being a witness to the Gentiles and all of that would seem chronologically out of place when he's only sending them out for a short time to villages only of Israel. So I think that it really belongs to the Olivet Discourse. I think that's where it fits the context better. And Matthew's bringing it in here just fits with his general, to me, it fits with his general topical style, where he apparently felt like this particular topic of various things the disciples would encounter while preaching the gospel could be inserted at this point profitably, where he's telling about the first time Jesus sent them out on a short-term outreach. I can't always explain why Matthew chooses to group the things he does, but I think that the evidence would be that this particular piece really belongs to the Olivet Discourse and not so much to the occasion of him sending out the 12.
Yeah, okay, that sounds reasonable. He does actually exclude the statement about the gospel being preached first to all the nations in his version of it. But he does include various things like them being brought before governors and kings and so forth. And to my knowledge, that never happened until after the crucifixion and resurrection.
Right. Right. The statement about being witnesses to all nations is found in Matthew 24:14.
Right.
In the Olivet, but
not in Matthew 10. Which
not in Matthew 10. That's right.
Yeah.
But you see, the passage you're talking about, Matthew 10, seems to be more connected to that material in Matthew 24.
Right.
In terms of its fulfillment. Yeah.
Right. Okay, now, at the end of each of those sections, the one in Matthew 10, verse 22, and Mark 13:13, they both say, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. What end do you think that's referring to? And then right after that, in verse 23 of Matthew 10, it talks about before the Son of Man comes, and which coming do you think that refers to? It sounds kind of like it probably has to be referring to his coming into Jerusalem riding on a donkey.
Well, there's any number of possibilities to that. I personally think he's referring there to his coming in judgment in A.D. 70, but there's other possibilities. When he says, you will not, well, verse 23 says, when they persecute you in this city, flee to another, for assuredly I say to you, you will not have gone through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes. Before I knew anything about the significance of A.D. 70 and the frequency with which it is referred to as Jesus coming in Scripture, I used to think this passage must mean You will not have reached all the villages of Israel before the Son of Man comes, that is, to rejoin you. Although it's not recorded here, he must have had some kind of planned rendezvous with the disciples at the end of this outreach, when they would regather and compare, report back to him and so forth. And so my thought was, the Son of Man coming would mean, until the Son of Man comes to where we are going to meet, to our rendezvous point, at the end of this outreach, he seems to be limiting their opportunity in terms of time to reach all the villages of Israel. And I initially thought, many years ago, that he was limiting it by the limits to that short-term outreach, that, you're not going to have enough time on this particular occasion to reach all those villages, because before you do, we will re-meet, we will rejoin. The Son of Man will come to the rendezvous point, we will be done with this particular phase of outreach. But I think that's not the case. Now, you mentioned, coming to Jerusalem on a donkey. That could be a coming of the Son of Man. In another sense, he comes to Jerusalem. On the other hand, I don't really know that this outreach was supposed to continue until that point. I think that this outreach ended much sooner than that, and therefore his coming to Jerusalem on the donkey was not any official cutoff point for it. But I'm thinking now that till the Son of Man comes is a reference to AD 70, because of the many times in Matthew, I believe, Jesus uses that terminology to speak of that event. And it would make sense, because he's telling them not to dawdle, not to waste time. If a village in Israel is not open to the gospel, rather than continuing to hammer on that one village and hope for it to change, just move on to the next one, because there's too many villages to cover in the time that remains before AD 70. Because AD 70 would certainly mark the end of all opportunity to reach the villages of Israel, because they'd all be wiped out, as they were, and as Jerusalem itself eventually was. So the Jews would be deported from Israel in AD 70, and reaching those villages of Israel would be a moot point after that. So I think that the cutoff point for opportunity to reach the villages of Israel is AD 70, and that's what he's referring to as when the Son of Man comes. And that they must hurry, because they won't be able to reach all those villages before that time. Now, the other part of your question, at the end where he says in verse 22, you will be hated by all for my name's sake, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. What is the end? Well, because of its proximity to the next statement, which I take to be about 70 AD, one might think that that is the end of the Jewish state, the end of Jerusalem. The end of the opportunities to reach the Jews, in Israel at least. But I've always tended to think that enduring to the end really just means till the end of your life. Because one could not say that all the apostles, for example, endured till the end of Jerusalem. James was beheaded early on, and he didn't endure to that end. But to suggest that one would have to endure to that particular end in order to be saved would be to cut out him, and probably Paul and Peter were killed before AD 70 also, and maybe most of the apostles might have been. So I don't know that he's saying that in order to be saved you must endure until 70 AD, or to any other fixed point in time. I think enduring to the end of your life is really what it means. As in Revelation 2:10, Jesus said to the church of Smyrna, be faithful unto death, and I'll give you the crown of life. The point at which Christians must be faithful unto is the end of their earthly pilgrimage. And so I think faithful to the end is not referring to any particular end of any particular time frame, just the end of a person's opportunity to be faithful.
Right.
The end of their life.
That sounds real reasonable, since John lasted a lot longer than AD 70, so...
That's true, too, yeah.
Wouldn't have fit him either, so...
Yeah.
All right. Appreciate the help. That solved that problem at any rate.
Okay, we can't solve all problems, but we do try to be reasonable.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right,
well, have a good evening.
Thank you. You too. God bless you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right. Our next caller is also from Santa Cruz, and that is Bob from Santa Cruz. Thanks for calling, Bob. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi. Thank you, Steve. Yeah, I was driving through Sacramento a couple months ago, and I was listening to a Christian radio station, and there was an older gentleman on there, a Bible answer man, and he was talking about some kind of judgment that's going to start on 2012, some month and some day, and he had this whole thing kind of mapped out, and it just sounded really strange.
What show was this on? Another like show like this?
Yeah, it's a show like this. It's a really...
Okay, it was probably Harold Camping. Probably Harold Camping on Family Radio.
Okay.
I don't know that it was him, but it sounds like him. He's an old gentleman. He speaks very slowly.
Yes.
He has a very old sound because he is very old. But more importantly, he does set dates. He sets dates for the second coming of Christ. He wrote two books in the 1990s setting a particular date. I forget what date it was, but it was in the late 1990s. He wrote two books explaining why the second coming would have to be on those dates. It appears that he was mistaken. He's no doubt equally mistaken this time. Harold Camping is a Christian guy. I think he's in the Christian Reformed denomination, although I don't think the denomination is entirely happy with him, because he has taken a stand recently, in recent years, against all church. And he believes that everyone has to leave the church. And I think he advocates that people just be in non-institutional home groups or something. I haven't read or heard his actual statements, but I've heard a lot of people repeat him. And a lot of people think he's getting a little senile, frankly. I mean, I don't know if he is or not, but this date setting is really a mark of foolishness on his part. He's already set dates very adamantly and been wrong. Anyone who's not a little bit insane would get a clue and say, you know, I embarrassed myself by setting dates before. Why am I continuing to do so? You know, and I think that that's probably who it is. I've not really heard that, anything about Harold Camping making new predictions about 2012. I have heard a number of people suggest that they think 2012 is somehow significant prophetically. I don't see how it is. I haven't heard their arguments, but I certainly don't believe that anyone could reasonably say that Jesus is coming back or that the final judgment is beginning in that particular year. People who set dates always end up embarrassing themselves if they live past the date they predicted.
Thank you, Steve. Yeah.
He might not.
Thank you.
All right, Bob. Thanks for your call. Bye now. All right, we have a line or two open for you. I want to give you the number, and then I'm going to go back to the phones. You are listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. We're a one-hour live broadcast from 2 to 3 every weekday on the station you're listening to, or maybe you're listening on the Internet, as our next caller is. If you'd like to be on the program, you have a question from the Bible or about anything related to Christianity, feel free to give me a call. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And before I take a call from Earl in Richland, Georgia, I want to read my call screener put a message across my screen. Apparently, a caller from Las Vegas called and did not have a question but wanted to leave the following message. And that is, quote, "You have a lot of listeners in Vegas. We love your show, and we never want you to go away." Well, that's a thank you for that encouragement. I really appreciate hearing that, because we've only recently come on the radio in Las Vegas, only in the past couple months. So it's great to know that we've got a lot of listeners there, and that at least some of them don't want us to go away. I don't know if this listener can actually speak for all the listeners, and I'm sure there are some who would be very happy if we went away, but I'm glad to know that some of our listeners are glad to have us there. Thank you for that encouragement, and we're always glad, of course, to hear from our listeners from that radio audience, as we sometimes do. Let's talk to Earl from Richland, Georgia. Next, Earl, welcome to The Narrow Path. Good to hear from you.
How you doing?
All right.
Good, good. My question today is I've been going through the book of Job, and it's about Job's friends. I thought they gave very good advice, and everything they said sort of seemed correct from my understanding. you know, they talked about God dealing with the wicked and stuff like that. And then when you get to the end of the book, God seems to kind of blow all that out of the water. And I just want to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, their theology sounds very much like the theology of many other parts of the Bible, like much of the theology of the Psalms, for example. Basically, their theological position was this. If you are righteous, God will bless you. God will protect you from harm. God will prosper you. If you are wicked, God will judge you. God will hurt you. God will, you know, take away all the joys and supports of your life. And since Job had God do the latter, God had taken away all his joy, all his blessings and so forth, they were concluding from this theological position that Job must have done something wicked and he ought to confess to it. And he was not confessing to it. He was saying, no, I don't think so. I don't think I've done anything of the sort. I've been living as I should live as a godly man. And they got angry at him for that, and then they got more accusatory toward him. Now, what was their problem? I mean, if their theology was essentially very similar to that which you find in places like the Psalms and the Proverbs, what's wrong with their theology? And should we throw out the Psalms and the Proverbs then if these guys were wrong? Well, I think the mistake here that they had is that they were taking a position which is true, generally speaking, but to which there can be exceptions, and that they were putting God in a box, which is always a big problem to do, and it's a prideful thing to do. It's a proud thing to say, we know how God operates. And by the way, these guys were living before any part of the Bible was written. You know, Job lived before Genesis was written,
right?
Before Moses' time. And so these guys didn't even have any divine revelation to authorize their points. They were speaking from what we might call religious intuition, and apparently correctly in general, but not universally. Anyone who doesn't have a universal promise from God about something and insists that God must always do things the way they think he should do them is somewhat trying to second-guess God, trying to, you know, put boundaries around what God can do. And it is true. What they said is generally true. And that's why the books that give general information like Proverbs and Psalms, which are not making necessarily promises but observations of God's general dealings, they can say things like this. And Job's friends would have been in no trouble at all if they had said, this is what we believe is God's normal way of doing things. But when Job said, well, I think he's making an exception in this case because I haven't done anything wicked and these bad things are happening, I think they should have humbled themselves and said, well, you know, our theology, you know, may need some adjustment. We're not really, you know, we thought God always did things this way. But instead, they were taking their religious opinions, which in this case were actually incorrect. Job was an exception to that general principle. God was not punishing him for some evil he had done. They were insisting that they knew God and that God could not act in a way contrary to what they understood that he should act. And even though their general ideas were right, where they were wrong about God is that God has to always act according to the way we think he should act. God will never act unjustly in the final analysis. But they didn't have any concept, and they can be perhaps forgiven for not having any concept like this because God hadn't revealed anything yet. But they didn't have any concept that God might settle scores beyond this lifetime. You see, in the Old Testament, people knew almost nothing about an afterlife. There's virtually nothing revealed in the Old Testament about the afterlife.
Right.
So we know from what the New Testament is that that's when lots of scores will be settled. You know, righteous people may suffer persecution all their lifetime and die as martyrs. And we might say, wow, there's no justice. These were good people and they were treated badly. But we know there will be justice because there's a day of justice. There's a day of judgment and reckoning when God will turn everything right. But they didn't know that. So they felt like all the justice had to happen in this lifetime. And they felt like if God's doing this bad stuff to you, you must be a bad person. And they were simply a little too arrogant in their assessment of what God is permitted to do.
Okay, all right. That sounds good. Do you have time for just a quick little follow-up question?
Sure.
All right, good. I've never really known how to answer this good, and unfortunately a lot of critics have asked, but how do we as Christians deal with the people who say that everything that's in Christianity is predated by some kind of pagan thing? Like they'll say baptism was a pagan ritual, the cross was a pagan thing, the Jesus being the Son of God was a pagan thing. I know you've heard that 100 times.
Oh, yeah, it's a very common claim that Christianity borrowed from the mystery religions of the Roman Empire and Greek myths and so forth. But you know, if you actually read accounts of them pointing out where they think Christianity borrowed from some specific pagan ritual, there's almost never a very close resemblance. I mean, what the pagan ritual of the mystery religions that they think Christianity borrowed baptism from was a ritual where the initiate in some religion was put into a pit under a grate, and they slaughtered a bull on top of the grate, and the blood of the bull came down like a shower on the initiate, and that's that's considered by these people to be where baptism comes from. You know,
right.
there's almost no comparison. You know, I mean. And the stories of dying gods who rise again, you know, they claim that, oh, before the story of Jesus dying and rising again, the pagans had all kinds of myths about gods that died and rose again. That's not exactly true either. You've got a deity in the pagan world who is said to have been killed, and he becomes the lord of the underworld, or he lives on in some other sense, but that you don't really have a resurrection from the dead as we have in Christianity. I mean, there are some very vague similarities in some other religions to some of the features in Christianity. There's no question about it. As far as the cross as a symbol is concerned, I believe that the cross as a symbol is quite justified in Christianity by the fact that Jesus died on a cross. Now, they would say he died on a stake, not a cross, but there's some historical reason to believe that the Romans used a cross bar on the stake. And if, you know, other religions like the image of a cross or something similar to it, so be it. I mean, they don't have the same reasons Christianity does to be using it. One thing that has been pointed out, if you read books about this subject, is that while many are saying that these pagan religions were doing these things prior to Christians doing them, there's no record in history of most of these things being done prior to that. Most of the mythology. Mithras is one of the religions that they say Christianity borrowed from. Most of those things, actually, we don't have any record of them until the 3rd or 4th century A.D. And the assumption is made by scholars, well, these myths that are described, or these rituals that are described in these documents from the 3rd and 4th and 5th century, these describe rituals that were going on in the Roman Empire before the time of Christianity. Well, maybe they were, but we don't know that. You know, there's no documentation for most of that. There might be one or two things that resemble Christianity that we could document from earlier, but most of the things that the writers who are making these points are saying really cannot be documented before a period of time several centuries after the gospel was being preached and the New Testament was written. So,
I was going to say was that, and also I think that within every human being is sort of a marred image of God, and every person has an innate longing for, you know, communion with their Creator. So it would be probable to think that lost people, you know, people that started these kind of religions, could have some sort of the image of God. Would you think that would be a possibility?
Well, yeah, I mean, C.S. Lewis dealt with this question quite frequently. I think he did so in Mere Christianity. I know he did so in some of his essays in the book God and the Dock. This was something that C.S. Lewis was very familiar with. The mythology of the pagan world was one of his pet subjects. And he was an atheist who converted to Christianity. But his belief was that the reason that many pagans had similar kinds of ideas of resurrection or whatever that they're found in Christianity is because God was giving humanity I think Lewis called them good dreams or something like that. He referred to this whole category of similarities in pagan religions to Christianity, I think he referred to them as good dreams, or I forget the exact term he used, but the idea was that just as God prepared the Jews for the gospel by giving them types and shadows and so forth in the Old Testament rituals, so God gave the pagans a preparation for the gospel by giving them some of these concepts, maybe in a much watered-down form or a very different kind of form, but at least that the concepts were not entirely foreign, so that when he would come and do this, they would recognize in it something that's a fulfillment of what they in their rituals had already had some kind of anticipation of.
Well, thank you, Brother Steve. I don't want to take no more of your time, and God bless you.
Okay, Earl, hey, before you go, I know you were interested in the prophecy conference I'm speaking at in St. Louis.
Yes.
It may interest you to know I just received information today that the dispensationalist that was going to be participating was going to be a local Calvary Chapel pastor. As it turns out, it's going to be Tommy Ice.
Oh, nice.
Coming, yeah, so it looks like Tommy Ice is going to come in and be involved in that.
Oh, sweet. I'm definitely interested now. Y'all get that thing recorded so I can get a copy of it.
I was told that it will be recorded and videotaped, so we'll try to get it online.
Now we'll be looking forward to that.
I knew that interested you. Thanks, Earl. God bless you.
God bless you.
Bye now. All right, our next caller is Ken calling from Bermuda. Ken, welcome to the Narrow Path. Good to hear from you.
Hi, fine, thanks. How are you doing?
Good. You've called before, haven't you?
Yes, I have, yes.
I know we've heard from Bermuda at least once before.
Yeah,
how are you doing?
Fine, thanks. I'm doing great, yeah. Just had two questions for you. My first question concerns Bible translation. I've been doing a lot of sort of research and studying as to what would be the best translation of the Bible, which is, I guess, most true to the Greek. And I understand the two areas of functional equivalence versus formal equivalence, word for word versus thought for thought, and sort of the versions range between those two sort of extremes. In your opinion, what have you found in your sort of studies as to what would be probably one of the best or the best translations of the Bible, which is most true to the Greek?
Yeah. Well, I've given an answer to this kind of question to people over the years based on the translations I was familiar with over the years, and I have not been reading the newer ones. So what I have to say may be somewhat dated, because I do have an opinion about the relative value of English translations of the Bible, at least say 10 years ago. But I've been using the same translation for many years now, and I have not been exploring others. So there may be some others out there that I have not taken into consideration. And my answer, therefore, might not be thorough. But I've always felt that the New American Standard is a very accurate translation. I actually use the New King James myself, which I think is also a very accurate translation. I don't know that we actually have a translation that's 100% accurate, because every translator has to make some kind of, judgments on how to clarify a point or something that's strange in the original. But I do believe that at least the New American Standard and the New King James, along with, of course, the Old King James also, did specifically make it their aim to do a word-for-word translation. Now, there are other translations that may have aimed at that, and some of which may have even done a better job, but I'm not familiar with them. Almost all of the modern translations that I'm acquainted with did not even aim at doing word-for-word translation, but as you say, we're looking for a functional equivalence or a dynamic equivalence rather than a formal equivalence.
Right.
And some of them say that they're trying to go literal, but I've the ones that say that, many times I read a lot of passages in there where they're taking a lot of liberties. So I don't know what to recommend. I would highly recommend the New King James,
mm-hmm.
or the New American Standard. I think they're very adequate. If anything has come out that's better, I haven't heard about it. And even if something better has come out that I haven't heard about, these translations are entirely adequate. I think that if you're going to be interested in word-for-word accuracy, you're going to have to not fully depend on any one translation. You're going to need to get something like a Greek-English interlinear New Testament. Of course, there's things like the Young's literal translation, but that's going to be, he's going to have to make a few judgments too, but of course the Young's literal translation does try to do a verse, a word-for-word translation, but it reads a little awkwardly. It doesn't always read just like, idiomatic English. So I like the New King James better than any of the other options out there right now.
Okay.
That I've read. I mean, there may be some great ones I haven't read.
Okay. Yeah, the best thing would be to try to read the Greek New Testament or learn Greek, and I guess that's the ultimate, wouldn't it, if you say?
That would be the ultimate, yeah, of course. I mean, I haven't even done that. I'd love to. But I to learn Greek well enough to read the Greek Testament and never need an English translation would be great. But you would still have to use an English translation whenever you're addressing English-speaking people.
Right.
Unless you're going to translate on the fly. I mean, if you know Greek well enough that you would normally quote the Greek New Testament in the Greek, but you could translate on the fly, that is off the top of your head as you're quoting it to an English audience, that'd be great. But I think that would take a higher degree of mastery of the Greek language than very many Christians will ever have.
Okay, thanks. And my second question was, I remember one of the previous recording of your show, you mentioned your position regarding like your doctrinal, your theology or your doctrinal position, i.e. that being Reformed but not Calvinist. And I was wondering if it's somewhere on your website you have in audio or written form actually why you believe what position you believe and why you believe that position. Because I'll be interested to know what your stance is. I think you said Reformed. Yeah.
Well, let me clarify. What I may have said and what I would say.
Right.
I would say that I am like the Reformed theology in my eschatology. That is, when I think my view of the end times,
right,
my view of Israel and so forth is the same as that of the Reformed tradition. On the other hand, Reformed theology is traditionally Calvinistic, and I'm not a Calvinist.
Right.
Now, so those are the points. It would be my eschatology that is Reformed, and my what we call soteriology, the doctrine of salvation, where I'm not Reformed. That is, I would be more of an Arminian. So if you wanted to know my specific reasons for those points, I have at the website lecture series. One is a 9-lecture series called God's Sovereignty and Man's Salvation, where I explore the Calvinist issues, and you'll certainly find out there why I'm not a Calvinist. Then another series of lectures of mine is called When Shall These Things Be?, which gives my eschatological views in detail, and you'd find out then why I'm not a dispensationalist, but I'm more like the Reformed in that. There's not any one lecture anywhere that I know of where I just kind of sat down and talked about those two things together. The truth is, I reach my conclusions on each point case by case. I never have believed I should adopt in toto just some system of theology, but rather on any particular doctrine, I want to search the scripture and see what that particular doctrine, is in the scripture.
Right.
I think he was a Presbyterian, a Reformed pastor who used to call me once in a while on the air. He might even still listen to the program. I don't know. And he called me once and said, "Steve, you're an odd bird." He said, you've left dispensationalism and become Reformed in your eschatology, but you haven't gone all the way and embraced Calvinism. He says, "Why is that?" And my answer is because the reason I left dispensationalism is because I did not wish to hold to a man-made system. And the reason I have not embraced Calvinism is the same. I don't want to hold to a man-made system. In my opinion, both dispensationalism and Calvinism are man-made systems. I don't believe either of them are taught in Scripture, and I believe that that's why they arose so late in church history. Calvinism did not arise until the 5th century, and dispensationalism didn't arise until the 19th century. So there's a reason for that. It's because they're not taught in the Bible, in my opinion.
When you say dispensationalism, you mean like pre-rapture tribulation, the rapture before the
pre-tribulation? A pre-tribulation rapture would be part of that, yeah.
Right, right.
That's part of dispensationalism.
It's very commonplace in the modern church today, like the event isn't it? I mean,
oh, it's a very popular viewpoint these days. Yeah.
Like the Thief in the Night series, but like that.
Yeah, Thief in the Night series, the Left Behind series, and so forth. Yeah, yeah, that's all dispensationalism.
Oh, okay. Okay, thanks, Steve. God bless. Thanks, I appreciate it. I enjoy listening to your. I listen to my bipod every day, so. Thanks a lot.
Oh, great. I'm glad to have some listener in Bermuda.
Okay, take care.
Thank you, Ken. God bless you.
Bye.
Bye now. All right, let's talk to Fred from Las Vegas, Nevada next. Fred, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve, how are you today?
I'm fine, thanks.
Now, we're getting so many calls here at the station. People appreciate your program.
Oh, good.
I wanted to just chime in on Bibles, on translations and things like that. I've got...
Yeah.
I'm kind of like you. I like my. I'm more NASB, but there is a Bible that you can get online called the Net Bible.
Yeah, I have it. I have it. Yes. Uh huh.
What do you think of that? I think it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I have not used it extensively. It's. I think it's a very good translation. It's very scholarly, and of course, it's got a ton of footnotes, which are exegetical footnotes.
Right.
Which they're so detailed. That I have not really had time to use it to the best advantage. If a person had the time, the Net Bible would be an extremely helpful Bible to study, because the translators, they not only have made a fresh translation of the whole Bible, but they have all these notes explaining why they chose to translate it this way instead of that way.
Exactly.
Usually talking about what the different manuscripts say and what the different Greek words and Hebrew words, what their nuances are and so forth. It's a valuable aid. To me, you know, I don't know if it's ever going to be used so widely that I would pick it up and use it as my main Bible. See, one of the things I have to be concerned about is, as I travel and teach, I got to think, well, what Bibles are my listeners using?
Right.
Unfortunately, an awful lot of them are using the NIV.
Mm-hmm.
And I even once considered, well, because so many people have the NIV, should I teach from the NIV? But then I came to my senses and I said, no, I can't make that kind of compromise. So I stuck with the New King James, which at the time was the main competitor to the NIV. I don't know. The New King James at least is a word-for-word translation.
Right, and I wore the cover off of mine.
Yeah, of your New King James?
Right. My wife bought me a New King James Open Bible, which is one of my favorite Bibles.
Uh-huh.
And I taught Sunday school and didn't preach from it until I wore the cover off of it.
I've worn the cover off. You know, when I was a dispensationalist, I wore the cover off of 4 Scofield Bibles in a row. Right? I mean, I used them till the covers fell off. And these were serially. You know, I went through 4 Scofield Bibles.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. I love that Bible, though. 60,932 translator notes.
Isn't that something?
If they go to the website, thebible.org,
uh-huh.
You can actually download it for free.
That's a wonderful thing. I actually got a hard copy of it some years ago, and I'm sure they've updated it. If you bought a hard copy, that is a bound copy of it today. It probably is a little different, a newer edition.
Right. They actually have cut it back, too. They have what they call the reader's edition. The first edition has all the notes.
Uh-huh.
The reader's edition has been cut back with about a third the notes.
Wow. Okay.
I mean, they start at $39 bucks. I mean, they're not expensive.
It's cheap.
To get it for free,
mm-hmm.
You can download it. They have Palm Pilot software, and it's pretty interesting Bible. I really enjoyed it. I collect Bibles almost. I've got
uh-huh.
I've got a Torah scroll that I paid a Torah that I paid over $300 for. But
wow,
it's transliterated and translated. All in text. It's really phenomenal. So
wow.
Anyway, I'll let you go. I just wanted to share about the Net Bible, because you can download it to your computer for free, and all the translators' notes and everything are there. And I love what they did, because exactly like you said, they go, well, we use this word because it fits more with better than this word would have been.
Uh-huh.
I was very pleased when I read it, and I understand it'd be hard to use as your everyday Bible, but it's kind of a nice Bible for us collectors. Okay.
It's good. I think everyone who's a serious Bible student probably should get a copy of it, or at least get a link to that website.
Yeah, get on Bible.org and check it out. Yeah, you have a great mission over there. You're in Sweden?
I'm in Sweden, yeah.
All right. Well, we'll be praying for you.
Thank you, brother.
God bless
you. Thanks for your encouragement. Bye now. I appreciate that call. Fred has called a couple times before. He's the station manager at KKVV in Las Vegas, where We are now broadcasting, and our Las Vegas listeners are listening on that station. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we have a line or two open for you. We're going to talk next to Bob, who's calling from Halsey, Oregon. But you can still get on. We might have time for a few more calls. The number is 1-800-438-5090. It's 1-800-438-5090. Bob, thanks for calling. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Thank you. Hey, just a real quick comment as far as Bible translation and such. That's all I have. One that I really found useful is the Greek and Hebrew Bible.
Yeah, that's a good Bible.
It has a lot of what you were talking about, a lot shorter form. But
yeah, it doesn't. Now, did you get the edition that used the King James text, or did you get one that used a different version?
Actually, I'm more of an Alexandrian text fan than a King James.
So do they have the New American Standard, or what do they have?
They do.
Okay. I have it. I have those key study Bibles. Spiros Zodiadis is the editor who added all those helpful notes and things and numbers. I have it in the King James Version.
Yeah, and a lot of the notes are actually in King James, even though it's the American. But it's a very good Bible, good study Bible.
It's excellent.
The question I had for you is one I've wrestled with a long time. If you find somebody who's pretty well versed in the Bible and yet is still not a Christian, not a believer, sometimes they can pull up things that seem inconsistent, and then you try to explain them to them, and it just sounds like a whole lot of excuses.
It sounds like you're making excuses.
Well, if you understood the culture, it really waters down the whole argument. So let me throw one at you, and I want to hear it as if you're talking to somebody who doesn't believe because the Bible's inconsistent. Can you hear me?
Yeah, although you are breaking up pretty badly, but go ahead. I want to hear what you have to say.
I'm sorry. 1 Corinthians, Paul, I believe it's 1 Corinthians, Paul is talking about it's okay to eat meat idols, eat meat and sacrifice to idols. Maybe it's Romans. I'm sorry. Anyway.
No, it is. It's 1 Corinthians chapters 8 through 10.
Right. And I understand that he says it's best not to if you're going to offend somebody, but he does say it's okay.
Yeah.
In Revelation, you have Jezebel being judged for teaching that it's okay.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, if I was an odd believer because of inconsistencies, I could point to that, and say, now explain it. And of course, you could say, well, you know, she's being judged because she's just look at this weaker brother doctrine where Paul does. Well, that's not there. You're reading into it through that.
Yeah, well, we do, of course we read into it. We read into it because we know we have something else that qualifies it somewhere else. I mean, you know, I think people who criticize the Bible for, as they say, contradicting itself, are people who don't have any sympathy for the Bible, and therefore they judge it by a standard they would never judge any other literature by. I mean, the truth is that there's hardly any truth that is not, in some sense, nuanced. Right? I mean, the Jezebel in the church in Revelation, Jezebel is teaching God's servants to commit fornication and to eat meat sacrificed to idols. Now, these two activities, generally speaking, in the first century, were what was going on in the Greek temples, the idolatrous temples. They would go and they'd commit fornication. That is, they'd actually sleep with the temple prostitutes, who were the priestesses, and they'd have a feast there in the temple. And apparently, we do know this. I mean, even apart from that passage, we know that the early Christians were conflicted because they lived in a society where everybody except them and the Jews were worshiping idols in these temples, and it was a great social thing. I mean, it was just part of the society. It's like if you didn't go to almost anything that everyone goes to, ball games or something like that. You know, if you abstain from going. The Christians who were in those societies had to either seem unsociable or participate in those things. And so the pure Christians who didn't want to compromise, they went ahead and risked seeming unsociable. They wouldn't go to these idolatrous feasts because it was worshiping idols. Paul agreed that you should not go into an idolatrous feast. In the same discussion in 1 Corinthians chapters 8 through 10, and especially at the end of chapter 8, he makes it very clear that you should not go into an idol's temple to eat meat sacrificed to idols. He said if somebody serves you food in their home, worshiping religion and eat it there, because of course that ends up looks like we maybe lost your connection. I'm sorry about that. That makes it look like or that you're actually participating in the worship of the idol. Now I believe that what Jezebel was doing in her, there were people teaching the doctrine, it says, of Balaam, who also were teaching to commit fornication and eat meat sacrificed to idols. Both those churches had persons teaching the Christians to do that. What I think that refers to is this. In that particular situation where the churches were having tension as to how do we relate to our culture around us and still remain uncompromised, they always had to deal with this question. What do we do about this matter of the typical normal socializing behavior of our society of going to these feasts at the idol's temple? And generally speaking, the Christians were following what Paul said, and what most of the Christians would say is don't go to these. If we look unsociable, well, that's just the burden we'll have to bear. If we're persecuted for it, well, we'll have to accept the persecution as being for righteousness' sake. But there were some teachers who were saying, hey, we don't have to be unsociable. We don't have to be persecuted for this. We have liberty. In Christ, we can do whatever we want. We're saved by, grace, not by works. And they were teaching antinomianism and giving the Christians permission to participate in the idolatrous behavior. And so what Jezebel was doing, I believe, in Thyatira and what those who were teaching the doctrine of Balaam and Pergamos were doing, they were saying, this tension that Christians are feeling between themselves and society can be alleviated. Just don't worry about it. Just go in ahead and participate. Now, Paul himself didn't agree with that. There's no conflict here between Paul and and Christ in his objections to what Jezebel was teaching here, because Paul, in his discussion, makes it clear that going into the idolatrous feasts is stepping over the line. Although in 1 Corinthians 8 he says an idol is nothing at all, and meat sacrificed to idols doesn't have any magical curse attached to it that's going to kill you or defile you if you eat it, yet he says in verse 10, if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things offered to idols, and you'll destroy him? In other words, Paul's saying, don't do that. Don't go into an idol's temple and do that. What he did teach was that you can eat meat sacrificed to idols essentially if it's accidental. You can buy food in the marketplace or food that's served to you. If you don't know that it's sacrificed to idols, it won't hurt you. But if you are deliberately participating in an idolatrous feast, Paul said that's not appropriate. And that's the same thing that Jesus would say in Revelation chapter 2 about those churches, Pergamos and Thyatira. I'm sorry trying to wind this down so hastily. There's more I could say, but I've got 45 seconds before I'm cut off. I hope that may help, but I know there's other cases. I'd be glad to talk about them case by case with you on another occasion. We're out of time today. You've been listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to help contribute to our paying for the radio time that we pay for, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. You can find that address and many free resources at our website, thenarrowpath.com. My name is Steve Gregg. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again tomorrow. We'll continue our discussion.